Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today we're speaking with Dr. Frank Adamson. Dr. Adamson is an expert in the effort to privatize public education in the United States and international context. He is currently an assistant professor of education policy at the California State University of Sacramento. Dr. Adamson, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show. And before we begin, I would just like to say that I recognize that we're in a very dynamic and difficult time. And I just wanted to also recognize the hard work that so many of our essential workers and our educators are doing in this time. And be in solidarity with them.
Thank you for that, Frank. So I want to start by asking about the differences between a public system of education and a private system of education. What would you say are the characteristics that make each system unique?
So when I think about the education privatization and education as a public sector, I put it on a continuum. And I think about it on a continuum in three different ways. I think about what is the definition, how did we get here, and what are some current examples? So when we look at, and we just did this, we're publishing, by the time this interview comes out, it will be published, a primer on education privatization. So it's a short 12-pager that really lays this out so people can see it. But the basic idea is we looked at definitions from Hank Levin, from Tony Verger, and the World Bank, and we identified three main ingredients to privatization. One is the question of funding. Some systems are funded with tax dollars. Other systems are funded with private money. So the question is, do families or governments fund? But there are also the issues of management, right? So who oversees the content and delivery of education? And then ownership. Who owns the physical capital, like a school building? So that's the kind of the definitional elements that I want to put on the table. And then there's a question of how did we get here? Another thing we look at is that the road to increased privatization follows many different pathways. And there are some pathways such as ideological pathways, where there's a marker rhetoric of choice and competition that influences policymakers to incorporate different forms of education privatization. And then we have the disaster opportunity, where we see in what Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism, when disasters are used as a chance to fundamentally restructure systems. And we see that in what happened in New Orleans in Haiti and what was attempted in Puerto Rico in terms of fundamentally changing the system overnight without public input because everyone is trying to navigate the current circumstances. And of course, we're watching the situation develop right now across sectors in response to COVID-19. So the third part of it is, so we've got the, you know, what are the definitions? What are the components? We've got the, how do we get here? And then, you know, just some of these examples, right? So when we start combining this, we think about the issue of private schools. So private schools have private funding, private management, and private ownership. They're fully private. You move up on the continuum to vouchers. Vouchers have public funding, but then they have private management and private ownership. And then you move to charters. Charters are mostly public funding, but the management is mainly private in the sense of there are some district-run charters, but mostly it's smaller mom-and-pop shops or charter management organizations that don't have publicly elected boards. And then you have ownership of the of the physical capital. So sometimes the ownership can be private, and it's actually a highly contested space about ownership, but usually it's a public school building. And then charter schools have various relationships, leases, and things like that. And so it gets to be a very murky area. So, you know, the short answer is it's a very complex dynamic of the spectrum between what we consider quote unquote public or private. But what we do in this paper and what others have done is really try to unpack it so that we can better understand what we're talking about in terms of privatization or a more public look.
So I want to ask you on a global scale, a lot of your work has focused on not only on a U.S. educational context, but an international context. You, along with Bjorn Astrand and Linda Darling-Hammond, co-edited a volume entitled Global Education Reform: How Privatization and Public Investment Influence Education Outcomes. So what have you found about the differences in outcomes that arise from both the approach used in privatization and public investment? And within this work, how have you found that policy ideas spread across international contexts? So for example, is it the case that other countries attempt to replicate what we do in the United States, or does the US borrow from international contexts?
So the thesis of the book that you mentioned, Global Education Reformed, is that we compared three countries, three pairs of countries on three continents, and one of them pursued a public investment approach and one pursued a privatization approach. And essentially the outcomes heavily favored the public investment approach. The three pairs of countries were in Europe, we looked at Finland and Sweden, Finland having a public investment approach and Sweden having privatized. In the United States, in North America, we looked at the United States and Canada. They're both federal systems, so they're a little bit asymmetrical in their approaches by province or by state. So we looked at different examples within the U.S. of privatization in New Orleans and in Milwaukee. And then we looked at Ontario as a case of public investment. And finally, we actually began the study with Chile and Cuba. And Cuba was just actually, their education was cited in this recent presidential race where as a shining beacon within Latin America for its high quality education system, despite it being under the autocratic government. And indeed, our research does show that Cuba has publicly invested in its system and that it does quite well. And Chile, on the other hand, was really the original global neoliberal test case for privatization and in particular vouchers in education system. So one of the main themes that we found in these public investment countries is that really it's about investing in your teachers. Those countries, you know, in Finland, they pay teachers to go to school. And the reality of it is in the U.S. that, you know, we couldn't even afford a Finnish teacher in most of our school districts with what we pay because they have, you know, so many fewer contact hours and they have time for collaboration and really delivering education the way that we know that it works and that it clearly does work. These three countries, Finland and then Ontario and Cuba, all have very high performance. And I think the Finland and Sweden model in comparison is probably the most compelling one because of the cultural similarities, but vastly different outcomes. In the late 90s, Sweden marketized their system. And over the next 15 years, their test scores dropped like a rock. On PISA and international assessments, they were, you know, they were up very high, well above the OECD mean. The OECD is the international group of industrialized countries. Whereas Finland has been the PISA darling, they were in a way saved by the PISA because the Finnish business community wanted to follow the Swedish lead. But in 2000, the PISA results came out. They were quite high. And there was no way that the business community could say that you're not doing a good job. So in terms of your second question of like, where does this originate from? Does the U.S. create this and replicate it? You know, you're really asking a policy borrowing question, right? The idea of policy borrowing is that policies originate in one place and then other countries take them up and recreate or reconstitute them as their own. And I think in a way it's sort of chicken and egg at this point because we've gone around the loop so many times. When I say chicken and egg, in the first chapter of our book, I actually went back and I'm like, okay, where did this start? Well, we have Milton Friedman and neoliberalism. Well, who was influencing Milton Friedman? Okay, we went back to Friedrich von Hayek and John Maynard Keynes as this kind of original question of macroeconomics and which approach was the best. A market-based one, or one that's focused on the government and public sectors? And that question has really haunted the 20th century. But Milton Friedman, his idea that came out of the Chicago School, was taken up by Augusto Pinochet in Chile, and that was the idea of a subsidiary state. A subsidiary state is one where the state doesn't really provide all of the social sector safety nets that we would associate with a modern welfare state, but it only steps in at the last moment, and everything else is privatized or really delivered by the corporate sector or the market. And that model has been replicated in the United States. So it's kind of like went from the United States down to Chile, came back from here. And you fast forward to today, where you have the Prime Minister of Liberia citing the charter school system in New Orleans as a reason for privatizing Liberia's entire system of education. And he's doing this in a speech at a think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, that's a free market think tank in Washington, D.C. And so this really creates what I have called, and I wrote a paper for NEPC that was a review of Beyond the Mirage. And in that paper, I described a closed loop ecosystem of education privatization. And that is an example of how this policy borrowing is occurring within a particular confine of a conversation of a certain set of actors. Fortunately, Liberia's entire system was not privatized due to serious international civil society pushback.
So going back to the United States, you also recently co-authored a piece with Meredith Galloway in the Education Policy Analysis Archives entitled Education Privatization in the United States, Increasing Saturation and Segregation. So what effects is privatization already having on U.S. communities and schools? And are these effects consistent across all U.S. states?
Right. And I think that the U.S., the point of the U.S. piece for me was to really dig into what we thought were the asymmetrical application of education privatization in the U.S. And that's really what we found. I mean, the big news is that charter schools are about 5% of enrollment nationally, but they can enroll up to 100% in some areas such as New Orleans. So what we did was we created a heat map, and both the heat map and the data show us that the schools, the charter schools, which are the largest form of education privatization in this country, vouchers are around 1% to 2%, depending on how you count them. But they're predominantly located in urban, lower socioeconomic communities of color. And so we see a real targeting of particular communities and communities that have been traditionally underserved with this, new approach of sort of marketizing the education system. Now, a lot of people say, well, of course, these are the communities that have been traditionally had the most problems, they're in the most trouble. And to that point, I say absolutely, that is true. The problem identification is real. We do have systemic racialized gaps in education funding, performance, and opportunity. But my research has shown that privatization has not been a panacea to that problem. So what we did was look to see what was happening within six of the different districts by region. So we looked at two districts on the East Coast, two in Michigan, and two in California. What we found was that there is an increasing segregation in privatized schools, so in this case, charter schools, by race, and that there was student selection happening, particularly for special education or IEP students, right? And that's really what we find in this type of education system. That's the competition system. So basically, it boils down to what's called a choice competition quality axis. So the concept is that school choice, when parents get to choose schools, that they will create increased competition for those schools and that those schools will be forced to improve their quality. And what we see happening is instead that schools end up choosing students because they are having to try to game the system to win this competition, basically usually to improve their test scores. And they do that by excluding the students that are poor test takers, that have behavioral issues, or the more expensive students, because the other bottom line is also profit and profitability and efficiency in the parlance. And one of the things they do is exclude the more expensive students And those two groups of the more expensive students and the ones that are poor test takers are usually quite overlapping in the sort of Venn diagram of it.
So I want to ask you about your work in Oakland and New Orleans. As our listeners know, we are in a time of uncertainty on a number of different levels. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier was this idea of disaster capitalism, or the idea that crisis and disaster can open up windows, policy windows, for individuals to implement a privatized system without any sort of democratic process. In Oakland, these calls for privatization were preceded by a really serious financial crisis. And in New Orleans, the shift towards a full charter school district was facilitated by the disaster of Hurricane Katrina. So with respect to both of these contexts, how does the economic and political context that preceded these disasters help us understand what crisis only exacerbates, and what lessons can be learned about these contexts and how to resist calls to privatize schools today?
Thanks for that question, Chris. And you're right. It is a very important question given our current context. It even feels weird to be talking about education right now, given the issues facing some of our frontline workers. But I think that it is important that we understand, you know, that educators are also essential to the long-term health of our society. And one of the things that happened, so I went to New Orleans and did research and talked to, you know, around 100 folks down there during my research. And the one point that was driven home all the time was, we didn't know what was happening until it was too late. And I had parents telling me, please go tell other people what's going on here, because we've lost our school system. We can't get it back, and we don't want to happen to other people. And what they were talking about is what you referenced, what we were talking about earlier, disaster capitalism, right? That approach views disasters as an opportunity for doing what would be unthinkable at other times. From profiteering, and we see that on, you know, medical masks now and in other things in other times, to a fundamental system change. And in New Orleans, that fundamental system change looked like firing over 7,000 teachers with no due process. The laws were rewritten to classify most schools as failing. And there's a major important issue here in that the recovery school district was used to then house the schools that were closed because they were failing. That recovery school district was put into place under No Child Left Behind as a federal mandate based on the now debunked Texas miracle of increased test scores using this turnaround model in Texas under George W. Bush. So, you know, this institutional setup was already in place, and then it was deployed to really capture the entire system. In any case, the people that were impacted, many of them didn't know what was happening at the time. And so as I learned about that broader lack of awareness, I started focusing on helping communities identify the issues that were critical to them. And I, in particular, worked in Oakland to increase awareness of these issues, such as school closures, the increasing charterization of the education system, and the accompanying budget shortfall in Oakland. And so these three interlocked issues are still, as we speak in real time, happening in Oakland, and different groups in the community are trying to really, at this point, preserve public education in Oakland in the sense that up to 24 schools have been on the chopping block for the last 2 years and would have been closed without serious public resistance to those moves. And some of those schools have been closed to the detriment of those families and the communities that they've served for a long time.
So in addition to your work on privatization, you've also worked with other legal, human rights, and education experts to craft the Abidjan Principles on the Right to Education. For listeners who may not be aware, what are the Abidjan Principles, and what was the purpose of crafting these principles? And going forward, what can we learn from these principles, for example, as a guide for policy and practice?
So the Abidjan Principles are a single document that brings together all of the UN treaty law on the right to education and specifically the role of private actors in education. So really, they're materially addressing the situations that we were talking about. And just as a brief backstory, the Abidjan Principles were created by a team of legal scholars in consultation with stakeholders all over the planet for over 3 years. And I served on the adoption committee as an education expert in Abidjan, which is in Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, last year. And we're actually also completing a book dealing with some of the major issues, such as the tension between the state obligation and the parental right of choice in the education system. But what the Abidjan Principles lay out at the human rights level is the obligation of the state to provide a free, high-quality public education and not to have that right supplanted by private provision. So there can be supplemental roles for private actors, but fundamentally the obligation is on the state to do it and to guarantee education as a human right. And a lot of the conversations have been around, well, you know, we don't have enforceable laws. And it's true that not every country signs on to every human rights treaty, although, and the United States is one that doesn't sign on to many. But the United States still has signed on the Treaty to Discrimination. And so there are legal mechanisms in place that guarantee that the state should be doing a much better job than what it is doing, you know, and in particular in the United States and in the states where we looked in the paper that Meredith and I wrote and found these inequitable school selection practices, you know, where these schools are exacerbating the very inequalities that they're supposed to address.
So specifically in terms of different policies that are being discussed now as viable options going forward, for example, online education. What sort of concerns do you have about this? And what have you heard as policy recommendations coming from individuals who are advocates of these privatized types of education?
Right. Well, I think in the current context, and this relates back to the Abidjan Principles, the Abidjan Principles are an international set of human rights guidelines, and a lot of that has to do with the role of private actors in the global south, which is different than most of what we've discussed today of private actors in the United States or the global north. And that is mainly manifested as the advent of low-fee private schools. So low-fee private schools are, again, addressing a real need where the government is failing to provide adequate education, but they are, instead of supplementing, they are supplanting that provision and charging students who can barely afford you know, the basic necessities of life to go to schools. And the one of the models that's happening is this increase of tablet delivery of education. So you have teachers that are delivering a very scripted curriculum, which we've done studies in the United States. I've personally done studies that show that the scripted curriculum is not the best way to foster learning. But nevertheless, they're doing scripted curricula and delivering it from tablets and charging, you know, parents quite a bit of money without providing what we would call optimal or even high quality learning situations or opportunities. And you can see how this entire enterprise is cost effective for the businesses that are providing it, because they're able to consolidate all the curricula. They're actually curriculum in some cases developed in the United States for African countries. And then it's downloaded into the tablets. All you need is a teacher who can really read from the tablet. So you don't need a highly qualified teacher. So you end up deprofessionalizing the teacher. And right now we're seeing this whole move because of the crisis, the COVID crisis, into an online environment where the opportunity exists to really further deprofessionalize teachers by replacing them in different ways with online alternatives. And there's what you can get to is this economy of scale, whereas 20 to 30 and obviously 40 or 50 in the worst issue classrooms in the United States, and then 80 to 100 in the worst classrooms in some of the global South. But you could have a class of 1,000 students that are online and you only need one teacher for that, right? So you can see where the obvious economy of scale is. And of course, you know, what are we then teaching at that point? How are students being tracked, you know, and really what is the sort of the holistic view of education that's being, you know, in my view, diluted by only having the online opportunity. Now, I mean, online is a great supplement to what you're doing in a real life classroom, but you know, we would be doing a disservice to future generations to say that there is no physical learning environment, or that's no longer necessary. But it certainly will. It is on the table in a way that it never has been before, and the strategies that were sort of honed in the last decade in the global South may now be re-imported in this, you know, bizarre policy borrowing feedback loop into the global North, where they originated as profit making to the global South. So, you know, and that's part of what I want our, you know, the listeners to do, would be to become more informed about all of these different levels that this is happening on, and really assess whether the motivations are about profit or they're about the best interests of the learners and the students. Because in my mind, going to online education is much more about this whole efficiency and profit model than it is about the health and well-being of all of our students across the planet.
So finally, given your work on privatization and your recent work on the educational rights of children, do you have any recommendations for our listeners?
Sure. My first recommendation is get involved. Little d, democracy depends on us, of people, to organize in constituencies, both big and small, and to find out what's happening at the local level in real time. So not 5 years or 2 years or 6 months after the decisions are made, and then to show up to either influence or become the decision makers for those decisions. And, you know, I point out that the United States system consists of at least 52 different little mini countries, right? So I'm from Washington, D.C., so I include Washington, D.C., and I also include people in Puerto Rico. So I don't, it's not just 50 states for me, but there's also almost 14,000 local school boards, and they're all making these decisions with varying degrees of a research base and a focus on the promise of education as a great equalizer. So there is plenty of opportunity for people to be, to have their own impact in the education space. And then finally, I would say, I think people should become informed. You know, the education privatization industry has set its sights on marketizing and making profit on the $5 trillion annual global education expenditures. And I'm not just making that number up out of the hat. I was at a conference in 2014 of the International Finance Corporation, which is the private arm of the World Bank. And one of the CEOs there of said, you know, that currently the industry was making had a 1% market cap of this $5 trillion number. So I think people underestimate the scale of what's going on. And the ideas that are being proposed, just to recap, that is that they are selling privatization as a solution and using that rationale that I talked about, that school choice creates competition and it improves efficiency and quality. And the reality of it is, when we look at my research, when we look at the cross-country comparisons, we look at what's happening in the United States, we look at what's happening at the local level in the US, we see that more often schools are choosing students so that they can game the system, they can win the test score competition, and they can make a profit. And in doing so, they end up excluding more expensive students. And again, they exacerbate inequities that they claim that they were going to address.
Thank you, Dr. Adamson, for taking some time to discuss the issue of privatization in public education. I'm sure this month's interview will be a valuable resource for students and families and community members who want to push back against individuals who are trying to advocate for privatization in public education. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Diane Ravitch, who is a research professor of education at New York University and the co-founder of the Network for Public Education. Dr. Ravitch is the author of a new book entitled Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. As always, thanks for listening. We hope that you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on educational policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.